A few months ago, I was invited to speak at the Spring Cafe Lecture Series by the UConn chapter of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. When I asked what they wanted me to speak about, they said that I could talk about anything I wanted. So, of course, I cut straight to the big issues that were on my mind. Mortality, climate disaster, the heat death of the universe, you know, all that uplifting stuff. My thoughts on all these things eventually became an essay about trying to find meaning in a confusing world. Entitled Risk Delight, A Guide to Finding Joy in the Apocalypse, it was delivered on April 12, 2024, at the Waterbury campus of the University of Connecticut. Today we are bringing you that talk, recorded live at the event. You're listening to I Heart This. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. After years of thought and much study, I have come to a definitive and disappointing conclusion that I have no idea what is going on. I mean, I must have missed something when I arrived here on Earth. I mean, maybe it was just late. You know, like, by the time I got here, everything was already started, and there was nobody here to tell me the rules. I mean, I never even got an instruction booklet. So now, after 46 years of bumbling around, things really don't make a whole much more sense than when I got here. One thing, however, is clear, which is that the world is both literally and figuratively on fire. Rainforests are actually burning. And we are no more ready for the next pandemic than we were for the last one. And democracies are faltering. And we can't seem to stop ourselves from making terrifying technologies. And we've built our entire lives on things that destroy the very life support systems of our spaceship Earth. It is a real life apocalypse, but it is a strange and slow moving one. You know, in some ways, zombies might have been better. I mean, everybody's got a plan for the zombie apocalypse. Like, I figure if it was actually zombies, somebody would know what to do. But apparently, we can't sign up for the apocalypse that we get. But I can't shake this, like, cloying sense that I ought to be doing something about it. I mean, truth is, I want to be doing something about it. I don't want democracies to falter or for the world to unravel in climate chaos. I mean, there are a lot of people out there in great pain, and things that I love are being destroyed forever, and I want to save them all. But with so many things going wrong all at once, I don't really know where to start. It doesn't help that even with an apocalypse, everyday life is really hard. Does anyone here know the Swedish author Fredrik Backman? Oh my gosh, you guys got to check out his book, Anxious People. Here's an excerpt from it. He says, "There's such an unbelievable amount that we're all supposed to be able to cope with these days. I mean, you're supposed to have a job and somewhere to live and a family, and you're supposed to pay taxes and have clean underwear and remember the password to your damn Wi-Fi. Our hearts are bars of soap that we keep losing hold of. The moment we relax, they drift off and fall in love and get broken all in the wink of an eye. We're not in control. So we learn to pretend all the time about our jobs and our marriages and our children and everything else. We pretend we're normal and that we're reasonably well educated and that we understand things like amortization levels and inflation rates and that we know how sex works. I mean, in truth, we know as much about sex as we do about USB leads, and it always takes us four tries to get those little buggers in. We pretend to be good parents when all we really do is provide our kids with food and clothing and tell them off when they put chewing gum they find in the ground in their mouths. I mean, we tried keeping tropical fish once, and they all died. And we really don't know more about children than tropical fish. So the responsibility frightens the life out of us each morning. We don't have a plan. We just do our best to get through the day because there will be another one coming tomorrow. Sometimes it hurts. It really hurts for no other reason than the fact that our skin doesn't feel like it's ours. And sometimes we panic because the bills need paying, and we have to be grown-ups, and we don't know how because it's so horribly, desperately easy to fail at being a grown-up. And because everyone loves someone. And anyone who loves someone has had those desperate nights where we lie awake trying to figure out how we can afford to carry on being a human being. So, there are the global catastrophes and the ongoing catastrophe of just making it day to day. But there is another apocalypse, a personal one. Because yes, civilization as we know it might be ending, but there's also the end of me. Right? Eventually and unavoidably, I am going to lose everything I have and everything and everyone I love. And it's not just me. Somewhere else, a husband is watching the only woman he will ever love shut the trunk on an old blue Volkswagen, the one that belongs to the lawyer she met while he was away too much on business. And somewhere, a mother holds the smooth round head of her child, cleared of its soft blonde hair by the chemo, and places it over the hole in her chest where her heart used to be. We are all in this same boat together. The apocalypse is happening now, and it has been happening from the beginning. What are we supposed to do? I can't think of a question that matters more. Other than being a human being, I don't have any particular expertise in this area. I am a science teacher and an essayist who writes a podcast about gratitude for nerds. And we've already established that I have no idea what's going on. But I can tell you what I want. I want to be a good person, or at least not be a bad person. And in light of all that existential calamity, it feels a little selfish to say so, but sometimes I just want to be happy. And it turns out that I am no better prepared for that than I am for dealing with, like, nuclear proliferation. Maybe that was in the instruction booklet I didn't get. So most days, this is what I do, right? I try to get my kids to school on time. I put my dreams on hold just a little longer to pay the bills and clean the house, and I try not to screw up my taxes, and then I try to make time to exercise, and I fruitlessly worry about whether my kids are going to have friends. Some nights I tell myself that even during the apocalypse, it's actually okay to watch TV. But then myself is not always easily convinced by that. Worlds explode around me, and I drive to work, same as always, and most days, I forget that one day I will grow old and be unable to unbuckle my own overalls without help. So what to do? Maybe to find out, we have to break the status quo. According to Buddhist legend, that's what happened to Siddhartha Gautama, prince of the Shakyas and the man who would later become the Buddha. By all accounts, he was a spoiled child. He wore the finest silk, ate the most decadent foods, and was constantly entertained. Servants waited on his every need. His father built him 3 palaces, one for the hot season, one for the cold season, and one for the rainy, so he would never have to leave, not even step outside, so that he would never have to set his eyes on anything that was ugly or uncomfortable. But one day, when he was 29, so the legend goes, Siddhartha did leave his luxurious palace. You get the sense that it was this kind of clandestine trip, because he was this sheltered kid who wanted to see the world that his father didn't want him to see. He didn't take anyone with him except his charioteer, Chandaka. And outside the gate, Siddhartha met a gray-haired man with missing teeth and wrinkled skin, who squinted because he couldn't see very well, and who cupped his hands over his ear because he couldn't hear. And Siddhartha asked Chandaka, "What's wrong with that guy?" "Why, he is old, my lord. All people are fated to age like this." And Siddhartha, who had never seen a truly aged person, looked at his own unwrinkled hands in horror. Further along, Siddhartha passed another person lying in the grass, writhing and crying out, his skin covered with sores, And Siddhartha asked Chandaka what was wrong. And Chandaka answered, "My lord, he's sick. All living things are subject to illness and pain." Siddhartha had never been sick and had never seen anyone sick like this, and the prince recoiled. And then finally, they passed a rotting corpse in the ditch, twisted and covered with flies. And Siddhartha was afraid to ask, but he did anyway, "Chandaka, what is that?" And Chandaka replied, "This is death, my lord. Death is inevitable for all of us." Maybe for you and I, who've lived our whole lives with the apocalypse, taking a walk like Siddhartha's would just be an unsettling reminder of the brevity and fragility of life. But to Siddhartha, who learned about all of this suffering at once, it hit like a punch to the gut. How could we just go to work and carry on? We're going to lose everything. The asteroid of our own personal extinction is already on its way. Are we really going to spend our energy catching up on the bills and taking the refrigerator to the dump? Heck no. So Siddhartha decided to do something drastic. He ran away. He left the life of ultimate comfort to commit himself wholly to the problem. What if we did the same? What would it look like? After Siddhartha encountered old age, sickness, and death, he set out to find teachers. And so might we. A trip to the library makes them easy to find because, you know, since the beginning, people have been trying to answer these questions, and for about 2,000 years, philosophers have been writing them down. So maybe that's where we go. In biology, I'm a biologist by training, there used to be a saying, now defunct, that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? Yeah, that kid's mom was like, "So Ernst, have you considered that maybe being a communications major isn't for you?" Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny basically is this idea that our individual development over time somehow repeats the same patterns that happen in broader evolution. And when I think about the history of philosophy, that rings true for me. So I'd like to tell you about how both my thinking and the thinking of the entire philosophy of the Western world went through a series of similar stages on these questions. So yeah, like all of Western philosophy in 20 minutes or less, this should be good. This should in no way imply that I have a firm grasp of what all those philosophers say. I will be the first to tell you that I don't. And please also note that to tell this story will also require me to share stories of my own journey of faith. This is by no means meant to imply a judgment or a statement about faith. Remember, I don't know what's going on. I'm simply reporting my personal experience because I've often found it helpful when other people share theirs. So, ontogeny and phylogeny. So stage one was trust in the rules, in authority. I grew up Catholic. One of the great things about growing up Catholic is the clarity. I mean, as a Catholic, the way to address the apocalypse was so straightforward. You put your faith in God and in the church. Somebody else has got this. Somebody eminently more qualified than me. And I may not understand the plan, but it doesn't really matter. The plan is perfect, and my role is clear. I follow the commandments. I show up to confession. I trust in a higher power that has me covered. Are you worried about death? Don't. Your soul is eternal. Do you mourn for loved ones that you have lost? You needn't. All of us will be reunited in God's kingdom. Is the world rife with cruelty and injustice and pain? That's okay. God will build a new one where the first shall be last and the last shall be first and the meek shall inherit the earth and all shall be set right. What a profound comfort. When I struggled to make friends, I knew that God and my parents loved me. my grandfather died. I knew that he was in heaven and that I would see him again. The great project of medieval Christian philosophy was assimilation. Philosophers like Thomas Aquinas looked at the writings of Plato and Aristotle and tried to weave them together with scripture into a single coherent worldview. But in the late Middle Ages, an influx of texts and translations of the Greek philosophers came in from the Islamic world and made their way into book-poor Europe, and the sheer volume of ideas was overwhelming. I mean, the Greeks had thoughts on everything, and they had all kinds of thoughts. Not all of it could be resolved with church doctrine, and confidence in the authority of the church began to erode. And as a wide-reading teenager who virtually lived in the library, something like that happened to me. Just like Renaissance Europe, being exposed to lots and lots of ideas made it hard for me to remain a Catholic. With so many different religions and philosophies out there, like, why is this one the right one? Changing my beliefs didn't feel like a choice. You know, I think it's strange sometimes when people exhort other folks to believe, like there can be miracles if you believe, as if somehow all believing took was effort. I never got that. I remember one time a childhood friend of mine tried putting this to the test by walking on water on the nearby reservoir. Needless to say, it didn't work. After a while, I could no more believe Catholicism was the one true catechism, then I could believe that my pencil would float if I dropped it. So, what did I do? I tried one ideology after another, looking for something that felt like the one true way. So for many years, I was a fanatical follower of a New Age survivalist from New Jersey who convinced me that the proper response to the apocalypse was to learn to start friction fires and eat wild edible plants. In college, I walked into a life-changing yoga class and began reading Sanskrit scriptures. Siddhartha and I were not that different in this. After he left his palace, he sought out the most accomplished gurus, sat at their feet, and earnestly mastered everything they taught. And then when he still hadn't found the freedom he sought, he'd go find another. For me, all of these ideas felt great for a time, and they all had their moments of inspiration and insight. I mean, even the New Jersey survivalist. But eventually, something wouldn't feel right. Then, in my mid-20s, I entered graduate school for environmental science. Now, in high school, they spoon-fed science to me. It was a catechism, revealed by mysterious lab-coated people, and I just took their pronouncements about black holes and mitochondria and electron transport chains in the same way that I had accepted the Gospels or, you know, the Yoga Sutras or whatever. But in graduate school, science wasn't scripture anymore. There were no prophets. I mean, credentials and Nobel Prizes confer no authority in science if you don't have any evidence. It doesn't matter how smart you are or how popular. In church, we chanted the word of God. Amen. In the lab, we said, okay, show me. You know, if you're right, when I poke it, it should do this. In science, we systematically shut down any idea that doesn't fit with what we've observed until the only ideas that we have left are the ones that work over and over and over again. And work they did, like precisely and consistently. I mean, I couldn't help but put a kind of faith in it. But all of that testing disrupted some of my most cherished beliefs. And I can remember this one moment in particular. I was standing in the university parking lot one sunny Sunday afternoon, and one of my friends was talking about getting a Reiki treatment or like going for homeopathy, I don't remember, something like that. And I asked her how she thought that energy healing worked scientifically. She was in the same program I was. And she said, well, I just think about them with separate parts of my brain. I think about these things scientifically and these not. And I realized I did not have separate parts of my brain. Like, for me, something was real or it wasn't. And I can remember the sensation of watching the Yoga Sutras crumble into dust in my hands and like blow away like sand. Now, in the 1600s, European culture was experiencing something similar because the evidence had showed beyond any reasonable doubt that the Earth orbited the sun instead of the other way around. This not only undermined the infallible authority of Aristotle and Ptolemy, but also of the church, which had incorporated their geocentrism into their doctrine. And however much people wanted to think that the church could not be wrong, it was hard to disbelieve the evidence right before your eyes. So science didn't just move the Earth from the center of the universe. It changed the grounds of truth itself. For his part, Siddhartha eventually gave up on teachers and ideologies too. Siddhartha lived centuries before the birth of modern science, but in some ways, his attitudes were prescient of some aspects of scientific thinking. He valued clear reasoning and relied on his own experimentation. Eventually, he found himself deep in the forest with a bunch of like-minded colleagues, and he, with them, began pushing the boundaries of consciousness to see how far he could take it. In my own life, after kind of like recovering from the vertigo of that moment in the parking lot, it kind of felt like progress. Like I'd grown up, and I flexed my new science muscles, and I wanted to know, okay, what's the right way to exercise? And so I'd go and research kinesiology. And if I wanted to learn to be more productive, I would read the studies on, like, you know, using the Pomodoro technique. Or if I wanted to figure out how to make friends, well, let's go to the social science for that. Want to be happy? There's positive psychology. I went from being someone who described himself as a very spiritual person to being like this hardcore materialist. After some initial growing pains, Europe embraced science, I think, with a similar enthusiasm. The world was a machine, and all we needed to do was take it apart and figure out how it worked. And with enough predictive power, we could dismantle the apocalypse altogether. Some, like René Descartes, took inspiration from physics, and they set about seeking unshakable, unquestionable philosophical laws. So he asked, "What can I know for certain?" and answered, "Well, I know that I exist. I must, because otherwise, how could I think at all? I think, therefore, I am." Unfortunately, that turned out to be the only fundamental law, and there was not much you could do with it. Others, like John Locke and David Hume, didn't look for abstract laws. They looked for concrete observations, testing hypotheses about cause and effect, and encouraging a robust and tolerant political sphere to encourage the free exchange of ideas. But despite this confidence that somehow everything was figure-outable, neither reason nor experiment could end up answering the fundamental questions of what we might be living for. I mean, what's more important? How I feel about my life on my deathbed? Or how I feel about it in the moment? Do I have a purpose? If so, I'd like to know what. I mean, what's more important, being good or being happy? There were hard limits to what science could do. And there were hard limits to what Siddhartha was trying to do. For his part, he eventually gave up not only on teachers and ideologies. Siddhartha ended up leaving his colleagues because he found there was only so far that the methods of his day could take him. One day, nearly starved to death, so the legend goes, he realized that the asceticism that he was engaged in wasn't going to free him from the suffering of life any more than his life of comfort was. So it's said that he accepted this bowl of rice from a little girl and his companions, thinking that he had given up on his quest, abandoned him. And so alone, Siddhartha sat under a tree and resolved to follow his own uncharted way to enlightenment. I don't remember exactly when I gave up on enlightenment, when I finally admitted to myself that I had no idea what was going on. You'd think that as you get older, you'd gradually feel more and more like you had a handle on things, but the more I learned, the less I seemed to know anything for sure. In the early 20th century, physics was going through its own strange version of that trial, and along with it was the whole intellectual tradition of the West. Starting with Einstein's papers on relativity, physics was getting progressively more weird. I mean, Newton's laws were counterintuitive, but you could explain them to school children. But this new physics was unintelligible to all but a few in this conclave of physicists. You needn't worry that I'm going to try and teach you about their physics. But suffice it to say that the evidence could not seem to agree with itself. In some experiments, elementary particles were acting like physical objects, and in others, they were acting as if they were unsubstantial waves. The fights about which perspective were true were heated and bitter. In October of 1927, about 30 physicists gathered in Brussels to hash out once and for all what this meant. It may have been the greatest gathering of scientific genius the world has ever seen. If you look at that picture, you can see Schrödinger and Heisenberg and Niels Bohr and Marie Curie, Max Planck, and of course, Albert Einstein. 18 Nobel Prizes between them. At this conference, Heisenberg and Niels Bohr put forth the proposition that there was no way to resolve the paradoxical results, and that the only way to explain them was to concede that there was no objective reality and that there was no detached observer. Reality only happens in the act of observing. It's a crazy idea. It is one that undermined the very principles that science was built on. But the math lined up. Einstein was the idea's most dogged critic at the conference, and he launched example after example that seemed to violate this growing consensus, but each one was explained. In the end, even Einstein had to concede. The world is not a machine. Take it apart all you want. You will never figure out how it works. In his book called When We Cease to Understand the World, Benjamin Labatut says it like this: in the deepest substrate of all things, physics had not found the solid, unassailable reality that Schrödinger and Einstein had dreamt of, ruled over by a rational God pulling the threads of the world. Instead, it was a domain of wonders and rarities, born of the whims of a many-armed goddess toying with chance. I mean, what's that got to do with us? I mean, really, what does all this mathematical dithering have to do with living a good life or with human suffering? I think the echoes of that meeting come through to this day. The uncertainty principle that they talked about wasn't just symbolic. It's not just a philosophical musing. The one human endeavor that had reliably and incontrovertibly delivered on reality could not resolve the paradox upon which its whole edifice stood. What hope do we have of resolving our more personal paradoxes? In some ways, this is the true apocalypse. It is poignant that the first thing we did with this new knowledge was to make a bomb that could melt an entire city with the heat of the sun. And so the quest was over. Our hopes of a sensible world crumbled. If there even is an answer out there, if there is a secret that will tell us how we might live, or be a parent who doesn't screw up their kids, or how to make popcorn without burning half of it. We have no hope of ever finding out. At least I don't in my lifetime. As Carlos Castaneda said in The Teachings of Don Juan, all paths are the same. They lead nowhere. They go through the brush or into the brush. Or, as William Butler Yeats said, turning and turning in its widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. After 2,500 years of philosophy, we are back in the Agora in Athens, and Socrates is looking at us, and he asks, so what have you found out? But we are empty-handed. We are doomed to just muddle through. The apocalypse has won. Certainty is impossible. And we stand on the bridge with the dark waters below. There is no hope. When Siddhartha finally sat under the Bodhi tree, determined to finally either find an escape from suffering or die trying, the legend says he was accosted by Mara, the demon master of illusion. First, Mara sent his three beautiful daughters who tempted Siddhartha with intoxicating pleasures. But despite his desires, Siddhartha continued to meditate. Then Mara set upon him with the terrifying and monstrous hordes of hell. But despite his fear, Siddhartha continued to meditate. And finally, Mara, the master of illusion, beset on Siddhartha with doubt. He made it so that Siddhartha couldn't tell truth from fantasy, wave from particle, until the world made no sense at all. And then Mara challenged him, "You have no right to that seat, Prince Siddhartha. All is illusion. Even that seat upon which you sit belongs to me. What voice can you find that will speak for you?" And the legend says that at that moment of enlightenment, Siddhartha reached his two fingers down and touched the ground and said, "The earth is my witness." Maybe we don't need certainty. Maybe we don't even need hope. I mean, we could despair. That wouldn't be unreasonable. But hope and despair are not the only choices. Finally defeated in looking for certainty, we could accept the meaninglessness of it all. What if we completely embraced it? What if, in an act of optimistic nihilism, we radically accept the uncertainty and the pain of the impending apocalypse? We will lose everything. There will be a last time you see your kids. There will be a last time you wash dishes. There will be a last time you shovel your driveway. But instead of despair, we could take Don Juan's advice. The thing to do when you are impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. What better way to vivify the days we have? When we remember that we were never owed meaning or clarity in the first place, then everything we have is a gift. The poet Jane Kenyon said it like this: "I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birchwood. All morning I did the work I love. At noon I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise." So the universe might be meaningless, but that does nothing to diminish its strange beauty. and it liberates us to make what meaning we can. Let's explore it with curiosity and the wonder it deserves. Let's continue to turn to our reason and experiment and intuition and faith toward understanding, even if we're not going to get it right. One time I was teaching a high school chemistry class about how electrons don't actually orbit atoms, that instead they exist in this cloud of possible locations. And a girl named Katie raised her hand and asked why her previous teachers had lied to her. But the orbiting electron wasn't a lie. It was a useful idea. All of those things that we did in those 2,000 years were useful ideas. I mean, you can do a lot of chemistry with orbiting electrons. It's a worthwhile thing, even if it's wrong. Our ideas, whether they're about electrons or about how to live a good life, are not perfect, and they are not the truth. But look at how far they brought us. We stopped smoking. We banned CFCs. We stopped putting lead in our gasoline. Ptolemy's geocentric universe wasn't a failure. For 1,000 years, it kept time and it got our ships to shore. Finally, if we are insignificant, that also means that we are free, beholden to no one. No vows of chastity or silence for us. If there are no steps to this dance, we can flail our limbs however we want. We can't mess up. Even if the world is groundless, there are things we can know. Like Waymond Wong in the film Everything Everywhere All at Once, we may be confused and scared, but we can still know with unshakable certainty and with no need for justification that we've got to be kind. Or as Jack Gilbert says, we must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. Former NASA roboticist Randall Monroe writes the webcomic XKCD. Anyone here know it? Oh my gosh, you are in for such a treat, especially if you're as nerdy as I am. All right, and in it we have these two stick figures. They're walking side by side discussing the human condition, and one says to the other, "There is no God. Our existence is without purpose." And his companion responds, "Oh, definitely. We are adrift in an uncaring void, indifferent to all our mortal toil." "Exactly," said the first. "In the end, nothing we do matters." "Totally," his companion agrees. "Wait, why are you climbing that tree?" "Because the future is an adventure. Come on." "But hey, I found squirrels." Even in a world where nothing matters, there are squirrels. Even in an indifferent world, we can be playful and kind and appreciative. And how much more beautiful when that playfulness and kindness and gratitude happen without hope or reason. In one sense, this whole philosophical rigmarole hasn't changed my life at all. I mean, I still muddle through one day after another, still worry about my kids. Every action I take to alleviate the woes of the world is a futile attempt to hold back the waves with my hands. I still drive to work while the worlds explode around me. But in another sense, perspective changes everything. I am so grateful that this is the crooked and imperfect life that I get to muddle through. I get to do it with these kids, even when I seem fated to screw them up. I get to do it with a woman who astoundingly loves me back the way that I love her. Even if the world is ending, it is so beautiful. How lucky I am to see it before the end. In modern English, apocalypse is synonymous with catastrophe, but this is not its original meaning. Apocalypse was a literary genre. The biblical book was part of a literary movement that lasted for centuries. An apocalypse was a mystical, dreamlike story in which God revealed profound secrets, couched in allegory and symbolism so that only the initiated would understand them. So basically, like our daily lives, they make no sense. The Greek word from which apocalypse derived was apo, meaning from or not, and kaluptein, which means to cover. So it turns out that an apocalypse isn't a disaster at all. It is an uncovering. For one brief lifetime, the world is revealed to us. The central mystery of this is not that the dance will end. The central mystery is that we have legs to dance at all. This apocalypse is ours. It's the best we're going to get. And there are squirrels! It could have been otherwise. Thank you very much. iHeart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Bryony Morrow Cribbs. Our theme song is used with permission from neosounds.com. New episodes are released on the 14th of every month, or thereabouts. You can find our complete archive with transcripts of each show on our website, iHeartThisPodcast.com. And I'd love to know what you thought of this episode. Send your thoughts to me at ben@iHeartThisPodcast.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider telling your friends or writing a review. And thank you so much for listening. As always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.